a singer.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
She stands up when she plays the piano.
I am here with Susan Sellers. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you.
You are the author of, among other things, Given the Choice.
That's right.
Could you introduce us to both Given the Choice and its lead character, Marion?
Given the Choice is my second novel. It's set in the contemporary art world, and it's about that moment in a woman's life when we have to face up to, do we want to become a parent? Do we want to think about becoming a parent? Marion is 39 years old, and up until this point, it's been her career that has driven her. Marion is a deliberately tricky central character. I wanted to write somebody who was very much enmeshed in the business world, with all that it takes to be successful in the business world. And I also liked the idea of writing a character who I hoped would be compelling, but that maybe readers would have a certain distance from. I didn't particularly want them to get too bound up with her as a character.
I think you succeeded, because I did find her a difficult heroine. Because she was successful, there was a certain selfishness.
And indeed, ruthlessness.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And she was the kind of woman to just sort of stereotype it. She's the kind of woman that men may like, but other women didn't, or other women don't.
Interesting.
And she didn't seem to have that many friends who weren't colleagues, or useful to her in some way. But she does have an extremely adoring husband, and she does seem to love her husband very much. And her husband is getting broody.
Yes.
In the extreme. He's the broody one.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, that was part of the mix for me, as well as wanting to explore pregnancy and childbirth and having children. I wanted to explore it in all sorts of ways. So there's a woman in the novel who has left it too late and who regrets that. There's someone else who decides to go it alone. And then there's Edward, who is desperate to have children. And for me, that was a kind of interesting thing. What is it like for men who desperately want to have children, who love their wives, but their wives aren't particularly interested? So that was another facet of it, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's been interesting to me because a lot of readers have said, I really like Edward. I want to meet Edward. I want to marry Edward. But actually, I think Edward has a lot of flaws. Mm. I mean, he marries Marion and assumes she's going to be a wonderful mother on really very flimsy evidence. And for quite a bit of the novel is blind to where Marion's real interests lie.
And while being supportive, not blindly supportive, but just blanketly.
Yes.
Supportive.
Yes. Yes. He thinks everything's fine, or would like to hang on to the idea that everything is fine.
And this novel has a particular twist to it, in that given the choice, it's the reader's choice.
It's about the choice that Marion at 39 is having to confront. Does she want to have a child? Is it possible even for her to have a child? Because, biology plays its part, and that comes into the novel. But it's also a choice in the sense that I allow the reader to decide what is going to happen to Marion. I give three possible endings, and I wrote them quite deliberately because I wanted readers to read them in turn. I didn't want to just do a kind of, it could be this and it could be that. I really liked the idea that people would go through all three of them and feel what felt right, what felt unsatisfying about this particular version of it. And the endings were very important to me, because the more I worked on the book, the more I began to think about what is it we ask endings in fiction to do. Without wanting to give away too many spoilers, there's, I suppose, a kind of real life ending where things are inconclusive, where, as in real life, Marion does not learn the lesson she should. And I hope, as readers, we're left wondering where that leaves her and the other characters.
Yes, I felt that one was probably the most realistic and yet unsatisfying, which, again, made me think about, like you said, you started thinking about, and it forces us to think about what do we want from fiction in general? What do we want from an ending? And probably just conclusion.
That's but also, so interesting.
Why do you think we like happy endings? Because there's also one, you know, probably happier ending, and then there's the quite disastrous ending as well.
There's the ending where she gets her comeuppance. There's the kind of punitive ending, which fiction also does, you know, punishes.
There's a moral to the story.
Exactly, punishes bad characters. And I mean, coming back to the idea of Marion being a bad or partly bad woman, you know, I was quite interested in this idea that does fiction need to punish these kind of women? Actually, Marion's not so different from me in some respects. I can see bits of me in Marion, you know, ambition, etc., etc. But I think there's a literary critic called Frank Kermode who says that what stories do is to give us templates. He uses this wonderful word, fictive concords, that we can use, we can map our experiences onto them and see where our own experiences measure up and compare and fall short. And he says what endings do, they give us what's impossible for us in our own lives, because we can never look at our own ending with hindsight. And fiction offers us, or stories generally offer us, the possibility to see what endings might be like. And I think that's a really powerful idea.
Yeah. Sort of the role of Greek plays.
Exactly.
To educate society and to see how these stories will play out.
Exactly.
For us, for you, exactly.
Exactly. And of course, Edward gives up his fantastically high-paid job and enrolls for a degree in classics. So he's actually actively thinking about all these issues.
Mm-hmm. Which ending was your favourite?
It's actually really hard to answer that now. When I first wrote it, I thought that it would be the real-life ending. But the more I began to work on the others and think about them, of course, I think in order to write, to really bring them alive on the page, you have to believe in them. You have to put yourself there. Yeah. And so now I'm not sure. But what is fascinating is that the reading feedback I've had so far, people have very different ideas. Mm. Some people really like one, some people really like another. Almost no woman I've spoken to likes the slightly punitive ending, which I think is fascinating. You know, we don't want women to get punished.
We don't want to wear a scarlet letter.
Don't. And some people have said, actually, I really like all three and can't quite decide.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. The kind of jury's out, I think, on that one.
And you did offer us more than one choice. Why did you do that?
Well, I think because if I'd given an either or, it would have indicated that that was it. Yeah. Whereas with three, it suggests actually there's a whole spectrum of possibilities here. And one of the things I really liked about the endings, and I tried to kind of weave this in through the painter who's in the novel, is the idea that outcomes are often the result of really quite contingent things, you know, sort of a chance meeting or a sudden realization. It's not the kind of big Hollywood turning point that all writers are taught to kind of build into the script. It's often quite small things. Mm. And I think when you remember that, actually, there are lots of different endings. There are lots of different ways in which all these different characters could conclude. And I think for women too, you know, the whole kind of post-feminist thing about choices is really, really, really powerful. But we don't always make the best use of those choices. And I include myself in that, you
know.
Absolutely.
And I also think we have a right not to make the best choices. Actually, because men have a lot of choices and they certainly don't make the best use of them either. But yes, I think you're absolutely right. We don't always make the right choices. And in our responses, just, you know, that biological driver. I don't know about you, but I remember when I first heard about that as sort of a young post-feminist, that, you know, the older you get, you're not going to be able to have children. I think it's okay to, you know, to reveal that Marion was quite scoffful at that notion, because I remember hearing it as a social message as opposed to a scientific or medical message.
And that's really hard, isn't it? Because that does drive an absolute difference between men and women. I mean, I know that the science now says, thankfully, that men have more of a role to play in fertilization than we might, than, you know, that was previously factored in. And that,
them being older isn't actually a good thing.
Exactly. Nevertheless, it is different. You know, there is, and I remember vividly, actually, when my son was born and going back and thinking about a second child, there was absolutely this thing about, well, I'm sorry, you know, 40, really, I think it has changed a little bit, but only by a few years. Mm-hmm. I think it's still really difficult medically. And the profession, as you know, tend to have all these guidelines that they have to follow. But I think it is still really difficult. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you need help in getting pregnant after 40, then as we know, I mean, it's much more difficult to argue for IVF, etc. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there is that... that kind of fact that none of us like.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice. RadioGorgeous.com.
Now, you came to Radio Gorgeous, unbeknownst to you, via the WOW Festival, where I met Hannah Quigley, who was working on a production of your first novel, Vanessa and Virginia. So there was a play made of that novel at the Riverside Studios. Tell us about that book.
That book grew out of an academic project that I've been involved in for about the last 10 years, which is to edit a scholarly edition of Virginia Woolf's writing. And it is the first edition which has really had the resources to look not only at the complicated textual problems of her work, but also to put resources into fully annotating her writing. And Virginia Woolf was one of these extraordinarily well-read women. You know, there's a myth that Virginia Woolf was uneducated, she didn't go to school, etc. Well, she had the run of her father's very extensive library, and we know from her diaries, from her letters, from her notebooks, that she was a voracious reader. And she read everything, not only the whole of English literature, but she read French literature in the original. She worked on the translations of Dostoevsky from the Russian into English. She herself, as a publisher, published Freud. She was interested in science. She was interested in politics. So for the first time, we've got the resources to actually annotate all these incredible layers of meaning, if you like, within the text. And in order to do that, I read or reread not only everything she wrote, but also anything I could get my hands on that might shed light on her work. And I read the considerable correspondence that she had with her artist sister, Vanessa Bell. And the sisters corresponded daily, often more than once. I think it must have been a bit like texting. You would have 3 or 4 posts a day. So there's this tremendous correspondence. And I read biographies of Vanessa Bell, and I read all sorts of things. And I just became fascinated by their relationship, which was an incredibly important and powerful one. You know, they grew up together. The boys were sent away to school. These two girls, very close in age, growing up pretty much on their own in the household, the parents quite remote, being looked after by servants. And they very much, I think, grew up as each other's companions and mirrors. So that really interesting negotiation that takes place amongst siblings, I think was incredibly intense. And then that powerful relationship really continued throughout their lives. It was not always trouble-free. It was turbulent. They were quite jealous of each other on occasion, as I think many sisters are. Competitive. When Vanessa decided to marry, Virginia flirted outrageously with her new husband. I mean, all sorts of... And they were competitive in work. But... that bond really did continue. And when the very difficult things happened in their lives, they were always there for each other. When Vanessa lost her beloved son, Julian, in the Spanish Civil War, it was Virginia who was immediately at her side, nursing her back to health. And of course, the more work I did, the more questions I had, and questions which the available historical materials can't supply answers to. And fiction, I think, can explore those questions in an ethical way. And it can also, I think, come at truth imaginatively. It can suggest things that the available records perhaps don't give you. So it was a real labour of love for me, that novel. And it was adapted by a wonderful young playwright called Elizabeth Wright, and performed by Moving Stories in France, Germany, Poland, various venues in the UK, and then for 3 weeks at the Riverside Studio. So what a privilege. Once I'd got over the shock of seeing all my carefully crafted words scissored away, it was magic. Just watching what theatre people do, you know, the way they build up a character, a scene, using the body, using voice, using timing, using breath sometimes. And then, of course, you have costumes and lighting and props. It was just such a privilege.
And you saw the reason for they're taking away all your words because they have all this other stuff.
Exactly.
You only have your words
exactly.
to work with.
And I love the collaborative nature of the work. You know, writing is very... it's very private, you know, it's me and my computer screen. I love the way that in theatre people bounce ideas off each other and try things out. And the discipline, that was also something I learned from them. You know, they, before they even begin working, the director will get them to do exercises. And I thought, huh, that's what I should do. I should start my day with exercises, breathing, some yoga, some stretching. Well,
it's still a really good idea.
Yes, it's still a good idea. New Year's resolution, perhaps.
Now, you mostly live in Cambridge and you are a professor.
Yes.
But this is a much more settled life than you have previously lived. You had a quite nomadic childhood and then you ran off to Paris and you've lived in Peru and Scotland. Do tell.
Yes, I moved around a great deal as a child. My father had one of those jobs where he was constantly being, you know, uprooted every... I think my mother said that in something like 25 years of marriage, she had moved at least once a year. So it
wow.
was it was a very nomadic childhood in that sense. Not always to fantastically interesting places, but it was very much a childhood on the move. And
not on the run, but...
And then I went to university. I started doing postgraduate research and had the opportunity to go to Paris. And I think that was... I think up until that point, I had been quite a well-behaved child and adolescent and young woman. Perhaps my parents wouldn't agree, but I think I had nevertheless pretty much played by the rules. And when I went to Paris, I think that was a time where I just thought, okay, I can start again in a way. I can start thinking differently. And I had the opportunity to meet some incredible women while I was there. I met and ended up doing a lot of work with Hélène Cixous, who is a very prolific French feminist writer. I think she's written 70 or 75 books and plays and opera and essays. She's an extraordinary woman. Women like Julia Kristeva, who's done so much interesting work on language and on the ways in which language structures us as individuals, and of course structures our gender. Women like Lucie Rigaray, who's written so many interesting things about philosophy and religion from a feminist perspective. So it was a very vibrant time to be there. And I was only supposed initially to be there for a year, and I ended up staying for, I think, in total 7 years.
Wow.
And in order to make that possible, I had all sorts of different jobs. I worked as a nanny, as a barmaid, made. I even worked for one of the best jobs, actually, was I worked for an advertising agency where we would come up with buzzwords. And the thing I really liked about it was not only was it well paid, but they gave you a glass of champagne. So what's not to like?
Raise my glass to my new buzzword. Awesome.
And while I was in Paris, I then had the opportunity to go, first of all, to Swaziland, where I did various things. I did some teaching. I taught. Swaziland at that time was a very interesting country because it was so dependent on South Africa. And any man, more or less, who had left school was in South Africa working. So it was a country run by women.
Wow.
And there's a hierarchy. It's the grandmother in the villages and the tribe who has priority. And it was fascinating. I was teaching them, teaching some of the women. And it just really made me rethink everything. For instance, I was teaching Harder's Tess of the D'Urbervilles. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you remember, but Tess is raped. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And she gets pregnant. She loses the child. And the novel is about how, from that point on, she is considered, you know, in the worst possible sense, even though it was something that was acted upon her and she should be considered the victim of it. In Swaziland, the take was very different because, obviously, absolutely no way in which you would condone the violence and the rape. But the fact that she had been pregnant was seen very differently because it was a proof of fertility.
Right.
So that whole Victorian moral code, which is in place for us to read Tess of the D'Urbervilles, was just blown out of the water.
Wow. So they saw her as a mother.
They saw her in it, well, as a fertile woman, and that is something to celebrate.
Right. Wow.
And yeah. I think for me, it was about that whole experience of going to Paris was about different perspectives. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I really meant by running away. You know, I felt a little bit up until that point, I'd been on the treadmill of school and university, and then you become a postgrad, and you don't look too far to right or left. Mm-hmm. And that's a shame.
That sort of picked your head up.
Yeah.
And what were you doing in Peru?
Oh, I worked for a women's aid agency, an American women's aid agency in Peru. And I had a very boring job there, actually, which was to do with putting leaflets and flyers, etc. together. But it enabled me to travel. It enabled me to see a little bit of that extraordinary part of the world.
Wonderful. So what is next for you? Because I just don't know what to expect. when you have a resume like that, an interest as broad and a mind as active as yours, I don't know what to expect next. So what is it?
Well, more volumes in the Virginia Woolf edition.
Fantastic.
Of course. We are just at the moment working on Night and Day, which is her second novel. And I'm also writing something. Actually, the new novel I'm working on is set in Paris, although it's about immigration into Paris in the 1970s and 1980s. So that's the kind of terrain for that one. And I don't have all the pieces yet, so perhaps it's best if I don't say too much.
Right.
But I definitely think it might entail a research trip to Paris.
I suggest a jazz and a glass of champagne.
Absolutely.
Come up with a word, maybe a whole sentence. You can congratulate yourself. Excellent. Susan Sellers, it's been such a pleasure to have you on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you very much.
Pearl's a singer, and they say that she once was a winner in a contest. Pearl's a singer, and they say that she once
She stands up when she plays the piano in a nightclub. Pearl the singer, she sings songs for the lost and the lonely. Her job's entertaining folks, singing songs, telling jokes in a nightclub.